Thank you, Herman, and thank you to Lenore for the invitation a few months back to speak this morning. For a time, the American Transcendentalists informally called themselves the Club of the Like-Minded. One of their circle, the Boston Unitarian minister James Freeman Clark, joked that they must have called themselves the Club of the Like-Minded because no two thought alike. I've been spending a lot of time with the Transcendentalists lately, and I don't recommend it. I can't help but think that in its own way, the Philadelphia Society might resemble these New Englanders. We too are a club of the like-minded because no two of us thinks alike. And this morning, I hope to continue that tradition. This panel poses the deceptively simple question, what defines an American? And Herman has already mentioned some of what I want to comment on here. The effort to define America has been underway for as long as there have been transplants on American soil. Let me be the first today to quote Crevecoeur. What is an American, this new man? A definition sets boundaries, and in this case, setting the boundaries or limits of what an American is or isn't quickly becomes contentious. Judging who is on the inside and who is on the outside of that definition is not easy. Is being an American a matter of geography, history, institutions, political theory, a secular creed, a civil religion? As a historian, I am most inclined to define Americans in terms of what they have been in experience or according to the long story of what they have said or written about who they are and what others have said and written about who they are. The American identity is homegrown and imported, as I said, I think the last time I spoke at Philadelphia Society. Others will be inclined to think about how the question, what defines an American, can be answered in terms of ought more than is. What are the first principles to which Americans ought to aspire, or beliefs to which they ought to subscribe, or behavior to which they ought to conform in order to be most fully, truly American? This approach is more normative than descriptive. Even when we define America and Americans in terms of ideals, we seem to find it necessary to rummage through the recorded past for people, words, and experiences that help us explain ourselves to ourselves and to others. We poke around in what Michael Oakeshott called the storehouse. This past is stocked with tagged items on shelves ready to be used in the present. The history of the American identity takes us back and forth through a very complicated interplay of experiences and ideas. Phrases such as city on a hill, that we now consider definitively, yes, American, have a history. At one time, Americans did not use the phrase. At another time, under different circumstances, they quoted it and applied it to America. And then at another time, they quoted the quotation and reused the metaphor for a different purpose. A new one, often at odds with every previous deployment of the phrase. Keeping track of all the permutations is hard work. Think of how many catchphrases have come in and out of circulation, each with a history of its own. Promised land, new Israel, chosen people, refuge, asylum, time's noblest offspring, the empire of liberty, manifest destiny, the American mission, the American dream, the land of opportunity, the American century, the American way of life, and American exceptionalism. I am sure you are already thinking of others. We sow these like dragon's teeth. I don't need to tell this audience that the American identity has been a contested identity, as Herman mentioned. These contests are themselves part of our identity, and therefore important to teach to students, especially as they become adults. Puritans and pilgrims argued over whether it was theologically acceptable to call any piece of earthly real estate a new Israel. The European Enlightenment had trouble making up its mind whether America was a place of inevitable physical decline or a place where mankind was sure to be emancipated from the shackles of tyranny in church and state. Federalist and Anti-Federalist argued about the one and the many. Anti-Federalists explicitly worried that America was too vast and varied in geography, climate, culture, and religion ever to be formed into one people. Virginians and Bay State historians argued in the 1830s over New Englanders' habit of starting the story of America always from Plymouth Rock. Which section would get to define the nation was a big problem. Northerners and Southerners fired accusations and counter-accusations whether Americans abroad ought to identify themselves first as Americans or as citizens of their states. Up to the Civil War and beyond, Americans struggled with their identity as a federal republic versus their identity as a nation. And as a side note, any successful attempt to define America, an American, has to investigate the impact of 19th century nationalism on that identity. And you can direct your questions to Steve Grosby in the next panel. Self-consciousness and self-identity do not remain constant. My own concerns about how to define America tend to focus these days on the tension between America as a place and America as an idea. That's a capital I idea I just read. To be sure, America has been formed by ideas, small I. But starting at least by the 1830s and 40s, philosophers and theologians in the United States, influenced by heavy doses of German idealism, started talking about America as idea, or the American idea. Foremost among them was the radical liberal Unitarian Theodore Parker, whose sermons in West Roxbury, Massachusetts, and downtown Boston were filled with such references to the American idea. He is an important part of the story of the emergence of America as idea. Somebody needs to write that story. The trail will lead you into the dense forest of Immanuel Kant. We have debated for decades, and you can take that we as academia in general, or conservatives in particular, or the Philadelphia Society even more particularly, over whether America was or is primarily Lockean or Burkean. This choice obscures a third possibility, one that emerged, as I said, in the 1830s. This is a group we could call the American Kantians. If you Google the phrase American Kantians, you get, as of Tuesday morning anyway, a mere 54 hits. Almost all of these are about modern neo-Kantians. One or two might be about 19th century Kantians. Google Books gives 19 hits, several of these duplicates. By contrast, if you Google American Hegelians, you get 1,280 hits. Google Books brings up over 1,400 hits. I should acknowledge before someone corrects me that many scholars do indeed grasp Kant's significance. Examples that come immediately to mind are Philip Gura's book, American Transcendentalism, Gary Dorian, the liberal theologian, his books on American theology, and Penn's Bruce Kuklick's Churchmen and Philosophers. And just because the phrase American Kantians hasn't been popularized doesn't mean that nobody writes about them. My point is that we have barely begun to uncover or recover an understanding of Kant's significance for American thought and culture and identity. We have done little to reckon with his influence on antebellum New England's efforts to define America. Kant, or popularized versions of Kant, and that's an important distinction, was embraced by leading American theologians, historians, philosophers, poets, and other public intellectuals, and he shaped significantly how they told the story of America and really the whole story of Western civilization. I am thinking here in particular, as I said, of the pastor and theologian Theodore Parker, but also the historian George Bancroft. Both were liberal Unitarians and Transcendentalists. Both were trained in German graduate schools and served as conduits of Kantian idealism to America. We could add dozens of others, including Frederick Henry Hedge, and to a surprising degree, I am only beginning to understand, Julia Ward Howe, author, of course, of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, but also of a number of significant essays on idealism and Kant, including essays in the 1860s on God, the Church, and the State. These American Kantians, even if Kant wouldn't always have recognized what they were doing with him, tried to look beyond the mere appearances of America to see the thing in itself. And that's what I really want to draw attention to. They thought that they found the ideal God in his perfect unity, the absolute behind or above all religions and superstition. They thought they found the ideal church back behind or above the world of the senses, occupied with such things as creeds and rituals and liturgy and the particularities of history, doctrine, and practice. Parker even got behind Jesus to the ideal Jesus, who could be manifest again and again in history in more highly developed forms. They thought they found the ideal state behind or above the mere historical experience. I'm sorry, behind mere historical experience, constitutions, institutions, and politics. And the historian George Bancroft, the best-selling historian of the United States in the 19th century, in volume after volume, read the deep patterns of history beyond the appearances. His sweeping accounts of the Reformation and Quakerism are hard to read today without laughing. I know this from experience with my students, but they were taken very seriously in their time and are still taken seriously by those well-meaning but naive students of the past who think old histories of America are automatically better than new histories. This generation of New England intellectuals rejected Lockean empiricism and the Scottish common sense realism still defended by the more cautious Unitarians, who up to the day before yesterday had been the dangerous radicals, but now found themselves outpaced by a philosophy they denounced as atheism. To be sure, German idealism was not the only way that Americans tried to look through history rather than at it. The Puritans had drawn attention to what they called special providences as proofs of God's blessing on their venture, evidence of his purposes in their own history and in the larger story of redemption. And there was a long tradition in America and in other nations of attempting to see the hand of God or the finger of God in events and to write national histories aimed at displaying this divine work. The popular literature on this in the United States alone is vast and has been around for a long time. If God is seen in nature, then God is seen in nations, so the assumption goes. The question I'm asking and I'm taking out for a test drive this morning is what did German idealism do to this confidence in man's ability to see through history into the essence of America? Did it secularize it? Did it philosophize it and de-theologize it, if you forgive that word? Did it intensify it? Did it make it more adaptable to other intellectual movements in the 19th century? I offer these thoughts, hardly ready for prime time, as a serious what if. What if we have missed a big part of the American identity? Or more specifically, what if we have missed a big part of how Americans once told the story of who they are, of how they define themselves? What if we have little to no memory of one of the most important ways leading figures in American thought and culture explained America to Americans and to the world? Let me overstate my point for the sake of clarity and maybe to provoke a reaction. What if the story of 19th century America is neither Lockean nor Burkean, but Kantian? And what if we are, by and large, still Kantian? And by still Kantian, I am interested not so much in the content, say, of international theory, the UN, or personalism in ethics, as important as these are, but in how we think, in how we do history. Do we start from Kantian idealist presuppositions that the right way to do history is to look through history rather than at it? To look through mere appearances to the essence that makes America truly itself? I am a historian, I am trained, and I trained others to do a lot of looking at things rather than through things. As a profession, historians get nervous about grand attempts to get to the essence of things. Others may do that, we may not. So here, to finish up, are the questions I have come to. I am eager for your help in addressing them. And there's the microphone. I am not ashamed to borrow brains, and I will thank you for pointing out my errors. Number one, we know pretty well the story of how German philosophy, especially Hegelianism, affected academia and the progressive movement in late 19th and early 20th century America. But before Hegel, there was Kant. Kant came to America as early as the 1820s, secondhand through Coleridge and Carlyle, and then firsthand from Kant himself. Kant was still a hot topic in the 1880s. There were two Kant centennials celebrated in 1881 in Saratoga and in Concord, the centennial of publication of the Critique of Pure Reason. I don't know anybody who writes about that. Does this matter? How did Kant influence the way intellectuals in antebellum America told the story of the Reformation, the Enlightenment, the settling of North America, the meaning of the founding, the set of principles that made America, America, the kind of foreign policy to which the United States ought to be committed, and so on. Number two, how early did American intellectuals start calling America an idea and referring to the American idea? Did it start with Theodore Parker? I don't know of anybody earlier. Who else did this? Did it complement earlier ways of thinking about America or replace them? If it did not replace them, then reinvent them. More specifically, did America as idea absorb the Puritan and Cavalier and Enlightenment and Lockean narratives into a new story? Number three, did American Kantianism leave us with a highly abstract way of defining America? One that is predisposed to devalue or just ignore the particulars of place, people, ways of life, institutions, and conflicts in favor of transcendentals. And finally, does the Kantian search for transcendentals, when transferred or applied or misapplied to the nation state, lead to a false transcendence? Do we look for transcendence from a source that cannot provide it? Is popularized Kantianism the gateway drug to nationalist ideology? The phrase false transcendence comes from C.S. Lewis in The Four Loves. Lewis warned in that book against giving, quote, a false transcendence to things which are very much of this world. Images do matter. America's images come from a long heritage of people, experiences, and principles. But Lewis conceded, I think it is possible to be strengthened by the image of the past without being either deceived or puffed up. But, and I will give him the last word, the image becomes dangerous in the precise degree to which it is mistaken or substituted for serious and systematic historical study. Thank you.